One reasonable hypothesis is that the ectoplasm is in a state of very high vibration, and just as the infrared ray is the transition stage between light and heat, there is always heat with the infrared ray, so it may be that the condition of vibration, for want of a more expressive word, which is used for the purpose of materializations may give the heat that is certainly in evidence. When a form has built up in the red light, its disappearance is of interest. Standing full length in the center of the circle, it is seen to diminish downwards as if passing through the floor. The period of time necessary for the disappearance is about 2 seconds. After the disappearance of a form, throat action is heard from the medium gulp-like sounds, rather similar to those made when ectoplasm is returning to the medium's body. On the occasion previously referred to, when the red light was detached from the fitting, it was used to light up the faces of materialized people, the lamp being held close to, and almost touching, the faces, so that there could be no possible doubt at all as to the form being present. 3 forms have been seen at the same time, in a moderate degree of red light. 2 of the forms were full length, while the third, quite small, was of Paddy, a boy of about 10 years old. At most seances a small spirit child, answering to the name of Matilda, skips with a rope, and obeys requests for fast skipping, hopping, etc. 97. The following are extracts from published reports, by independent persons, dealing with this phenomenon. Jack Webber gave 4 remarkable seances at Cambridge. He came alone and only arrived a short time before the first seance, so there was no chance of anything being arranged beforehand. Several well-known people were present, including an Indian prince, Prince Deo, and the Dean of Trinity College. Some members of the Cambridge Society for Psychical Investigation were present at each seance. The sittings were carried out under test conditions. No restrictions were made as to the method of tying. In fact, he was tied so tightly one evening that some of the sitters complained that it might stop his circulation. But Jack just said, "That's all right, let it go." On 3 nights, materialized heads appeared, and although some of these heads were perfectly formed, they were considerably smaller than normal size. The most remarkable materialization occurred when the head of an Indian came close to me, the features showing clearly above the luminous slate. The head bowed, and when I asked him if he could tell me his name, he said Ranji, which, of course, was the name by which Prince Ranjit Singhji was known when he was up at Cambridge at the height of his fame as a cricketer. I knew him quite well when he was up at the university. Mr. A.J. Case, president of the Cambridge Research Society, reporting in the Psychic News, August 12, 1939. For me, the most outstanding event of the seance was the materialization of 2 faces. A luminous plaque rose from the floor, and came within a few inches of my face, rising from it, partially concealed in what appeared to be a shining band of material, some 2 inches wide, was the face of a woman. I should estimate her to be between 40 and 50 years of age. The face was perhaps a little larger than 3/4 life size, and near enough for me to observe the fine molding of the features, which were illuminated with the glow from the plaque. Particularly, I noticed the nose and nostrils, which seemed to be perfectly chiseled as from alabaster or some similar material. The face was quite solid, 3-dimensional, without coloring, but obviously alive. I encouraged it to talk while it floated there, resting on the plaque, which was quite unsupported. The lips moved in an attempt to answer me, but produced strange ticking sounds that seemed to precede any attempt at speech on these occasions. Eventually the woman whispered, "I have no pain now. I do not suffer as I used to. Isn't it glorious, Mother?" Then the plaque withdrew and the face disappeared. The woman's face was remarkable for the fine molding of the features, almost like a piece of Greek sculpture. The absence of skin creases probably accentuated this, and while it was obviously the face of a mature woman, there was a suggestion of youthfulness about it. The eyes were partly in shadow, owing to the lighting arising from the plaque, so that it was difficult to determine whether or not they had been materialized. Yet during the whole time the face remained there, a matter of several minutes, there was no suggestion of eyeless sockets. The second face, which appeared after an interval, also came across to within a few inches of my face, supported by the luminous plaque. This time the strong masculine features were surmounted with a white, typically Egyptian headdress, the long Roman nose gave the face a look of severity, and the eyes, what I could see of them, looked piercingly into mine. This face was unlike its predecessor in that there was a suggestion of swarthiness about it. Pronounced facial ridges in the flesh enhanced the severe expression, and the set of the jaw and mouth suggested a powerful character. Several times the head bowed in front of me, and, projecting from the headdress, I noticed a triangular device which stood out and threw a shadow back on the forehead. I heard other sitters commenting on the hair. They apparently overlooked this triangular projection, which had its base in the headdress, and apex standing well out from the head. It seemed to be constructed from different material, and was evidently not intended to be overlooked. I commented on it, and, after remaining in front of me for a brief period, the head withdrew and disappeared. This, too, was solid, and three-dimensional in appearance, certainly more lifelike than the first, nearer to life size, and without the mask-like appearance that characterized the first, before it spoke. Needless to say, there were no sitters in the room resembling either face. I later learned that the device in the headdress corresponded to that worn by priests and officials of the ancient Egyptian temples. It apparently signified rank in the temple. This no doubt explains the repeated endeavors of the head to draw my attention to the device. Special reporter for the Two Worlds, published January 27, 1939. In the course of the seance there were five materialized heads shown against an illuminated plaque. They came to within an inch of our faces. They were not more than half the size of a normal head. Some of these were guides who announced themselves by name, and such names were quite unknown to Mr. Weber. 103 faces then materialized and came within a few inches of my eyes, and they were definitely smaller than Jack Weber's face. Sid. C. Carter, Two Worlds, March 3, 1939. Addendum: March 1940. In February 1940, the guide asked for the floor to be covered with white powder. This was done. In the red light, the medium and the white floor was clearly seen. Materialized forms were seen more easily against the white background. After the seance, it was seen that the powder had not been disturbed, proving that the physical materialized forms did not touch the floor, but floated. This peculiar gliding movement of materialized people has often been commented on with other materialization mediums, and the above experiment tends to confirm that they do not contact the floor. This raises an interesting point, for as the materialized individuals are definitely physical for the time being, they do not obey the law of gravity. Plate number 3S was obtained in February 1940. At a sitting specially arranged for the South London Press, when two editors and another representative were present. The photograph shows a perfect materialized hand emerging, probably, from the solar plexus region. On this occasion, another photograph was secured and published by the newspaper, showing the medium's hands held by the two editors, while the coat was removed from the body, similar to plate number 6. This newspaper published a laudatory article on the mediumship, as indeed has every other newspaper that has investigated it. It is pertinent to remember that newspaper men are, as a rule, of the hard, skeptical turn of mind, and invariably extremely critical of physical phenomena, and attend with the idea of seeing through the demonstration. On no occasion, however, has any newspaper investigator even queried the genuineness of the mediumship. All have testified to their bewildered amazement, and have reported the seances fairly. Chapter 18, Incidents of the Mediumship. The following selected extracts are taken from the Psychic Press and other publications. At Birmingham, 26 roses were apported into the circle through closed doors and windows and were distributed to the 26 sitters. The number of people sitting was not determined until the very last moment. Psychic News, July 8, 1939. At Birkbeck, there was a novel experiment. A bowl of water was placed on a locked piano and a jug of water on a gramophone cabinet. Despite the fact that both instruments were well beyond the medium's reach, Weber's guides managed to place a record on the gramophone turntable and play it, and also to play the piano. Psychic News, July 8, 1939. Several deceased friends addressed sitters by name and in every case correctly defined their exact degree of relationship. At the second seance I took my mother. Mr. Weber did not know my mother was present, yet my father spoke and addressed her with a favorite expression of hers. The tone and inflection was undoubtedly my father's, so much so, that my mother, who is extremely skeptical, instantly recognized it. 103. The roping was carried out by a post office engineer. My little son spoke to me, with and without a trumpet. He afterwards materialized within 5 inches of my face. My little boy asked for his mummy and spoke about a bottle. Asked, "What bottle?" He said, "Don't you remember? You put it in my hand when I was in the coffin." His mother broke down on hearing his voice. I asked him, "Where were you when that happened?" He said, "Standing by mummy's side." Now I knew nothing of this incident, but on questioning my wife, I found she had put a small bottle of perfume in his hand the day before the funeral. There is no possible doubt that the voice which addressed me, through a trumpet floating at some distance from Weber's chair, was my dead father's voice. My father's voice was very distinctive and unmistakable. He was a man of 3 universities, a member of the professional class, and a man of culture. His speech, voice, enunciation, and intonation were typical. Mr. Weber's voice is that of a working man and a provincial. To Worlds, March 3, 1939. The guide said he would dematerialize the medium, and before our eyes, in good red light, we saw the head, hands, and wrists vanish, leaving just the medium's clothes in the chair. It remained so for approximately a minute. We all then saw the rapid emergence of the medium. To Worlds, March 3, 1939. 104, Chapter 19, The Guide's Care of the Medium. Mr. Weber sits about 200 times a year, including public sittings and his developing circle. He has never ceased to sit for his own further development. It is in this developing circle that the guides are preparing to demonstrate in red light, to develop further the physical materializations of spirit people, and to conduct their own experiments to improve their technique for these demonstrations. Every possible precaution is taken to protect the medium from accident. During this large number of sittings, accidents do sometimes occur. Occasionally some person unwittingly interferes with an article still connected with the medium by an ectoplasmic arm or rod. In one instance, in the developing circle, whilst 4 trumpets were in levitation, a sitter's arm, on which a trumpet temporarily had come to rest, was moved. When such events occur, there is bleeding from the medium's mouth and nose, and once when somebody deliberately shone a light onto the medium, there was external bleeding from the solar plexus. It may be that the interference has been slight and phenomena have continued after bleeding, but as a rule the sitting terminates. The medium has also been unconscious for considerable periods. Black Cloud has explained that he has to leave the body to permit the return of the medium's astral body. If the condition of the physical body was such that the astral body could not return, the medium would pass over. 105. During these periods, especially during the unconscious state, the controls are administering healing to the body. On one occasion such as this, when after a seance a period of unconsciousness ensued, the sitters present tried various remedies without success. The voice of Black Cloud was then heard, telling the people to leave the medium alone. Latterly, when mishaps have occurred and a state of unconsciousness has ensued, Black Cloud has re-entered the body and brought Mr. Weber back to normality. It is noteworthy that on such occasions Mr. Weber feels but slight ill effect from the incident. At a sitting when the photographers of the Daily Mirror were in attendance, endeavoring to obtain a photograph of the medium roped to his chair in levitation, a mishap took place. Instead of the guide asking for photograph, he said, "Light," and the one in charge of the white light did not put it on. Again came the command, in imperative tones, "Put the light on," and it was put on. The medium was seen to be in the air some distance from the floor. A major calamity was feared. Then the sitters saw the medium descend in slow motion, turning a complete somersault as he descended, arriving on the floor on his head, the chair being upside down, and his feet uppermost. The medium and chair were stood upright by the sitters, and after a state of unconsciousness of about 20 minutes, normality returned. No harm or ill effect was felt by the medium. Strangest of all is that there was no bruise on the head, or even a red mark, where his head came into contact with the floor. See trumpet phenomena for similar non-injury. Mr. Weber tells of an experience he had as a miner. He was engaged on repair work, by himself, in a mine some 2 miles away from the main shaft, when his lamp failed. In the low tortuous windings of the mine passages it was almost impossible for any person in the dark to find his way out. Mr. Weber tells how a small blue light appeared in front of his face and guided him through the passages to the main shaft, where his workmates would not believe his story. This event occurred some time before Mr. Weber had any knowledge of his psychic powers. The following point can never be stressed too much or too often to people who attend seances of this nature. Never commit any unorthodox action, or interfere with any phase of the phenomena, or touch any article in levitation or after levitation. The medium's life may be imperiled by such action. The photographs show the nature of the forces used, but if also the strength used for various feats is considered, the harm that would be caused to a medium by the uncontrolled return of these forces to the physical body must be immediately apparent. Interference may perhaps kill the medium, or at least destroy health, sight, and the powers of mediumship. No research experiment should ever be contemplated without the full knowledge and cooperation of the guide in control. Author's personal note. The author was walking home one evening heavily laden with awkward parcels, and unthinkingly crossed a main road immediately on turning a corner, walking across the road obliquely. When halfway across he received a sudden impetuous urge to gain the pavement at all costs. No sooner had he achieved this than a coal motor lorry traveling at speed came round the corner. Without any doubt, the writer would have been in serious difficulties had he not felt impelled to take quick action to get off the roadway. There have been other occasions when persons associated with Mr. Weber have been helped out of difficulties. 107, Chapter 20, Electrical Interferences. A number of unexplained incidents have occurred during seances in which electrical apparatus has been interfered with and other happenings have taken place that may have a bearing upon the employment of electrical forces by the spirit people. One evening, preparations had been made to take photographs by the usual infrared apparatus. Battery, connections, leads, etc., were overhauled, checked, and found to be in order. During the seance, when instructions were given to take a photograph, the bulbs would not fire. When the seance was over, each bulb that refused to fire was placed in the light cabinet and on contact being made they flashed at once. At Leeds Psychic Research Society a similar experience was noted. After a failure of the first bulb to flash, the white light was put on, a new battery was installed, and the firing points checked. The seance proceeded, yet no bulb would flash. At one time an unexplained light was seen near the apparatus. The strength of the red light in the medium's developing circle has often been varied without human contact with the rheostat. After an incident at another sitting, when the electric light had been put on, the fuse controlling the lights in another part of the house was put out of order. In the two latter cases, there is evidence of direct manipulation of a fuse and the intensity of light, which apparently could be altered as desired. The contrary happened with the first two cases cited, and perhaps also happened in connection with the incident that follows. Obviously, the medium's controls would not take the trouble to prepare a phenomenon to be photographed, only to render their own efforts abortive by interference. It is logical that other spirit intelligences conducting research work of their own have been responsible for the occurrences. At times the medium's control has asked us to disconnect apparatus as other presences were likely to interfere. When it is considered, admitting the presence of the controls with the medium, it is only reasonable to assume that other independent intelligences can also be present and indeed that they would take advantage of the opportunity in a physical seance, where apparatus exists, for the purpose of conducting their own personal tests. A remarkable incident occurred at Wolverhampton in January, 1940. A séance had been in progress for a while when a flash of bright light was seen by all sitters coming from a levitated trumpet, which immediately crashed to the floor. The guide at once asked for light, when the medium was found to be unconscious and bleeding from the nose and fingernails. The organizer of the séance, a Mr. Herbert Wright, also a medium, was in charge of the light switch, standing outside the circle of sitters. As the flash came, he received a terrific blow in the solar plexus region. As he reeled, he heard the guide ask for light, which he was just able to switch on before becoming unconscious. It is definitely ascertained that Mr. Wright did not put the light on and was in no way normally responsible for the flash that was seen near the medium. During the 10 minutes during which Mr. Wright was unconscious, no respiration could be noted and clouds of steam arose from his body. When he recovered consciousness, his garments were saturated with perspiration, and a mark, generally termed a psychic burn, encircled his body. This mark was red in color and 3/4 of an inch wide, commencing at the solar plexus and traveling right round the body and ending where it began. This band was extremely painful, yet the main trouble experienced by Mr. Wright was in other nerve centers of his body. The author spoke to the guide about this incident a few days later, and Black Cloud gave the opinion that the incident was caused through a joining up of the force created through the mediumship with the positive wire in an electric pendant near the medium's head. This is the first occasion recorded with Mr. Weber where the power was earthed back to another person, and there is little doubt that had this not been the case, Mr. Weber would have suffered severely. Chapter 21, Conclusions. Many questions will arise in the mind of the reader who has read the foregoing chapters. To those convinced of the reality of survival, little more need be added, for they will recognize the operation of the wonderful powers of the spirit people, and while marveling at them, will understand them. To the reader not so convinced, some perplexity is inevitable. At the risk of redundancy, it may be repeated that the whole of the incidents related have occurred recently. That the mediumship of Mr. Weber is still with us. That demonstrations can be witnessed and photographs taken. It should be made plain that while it would not be possible to accommodate every individual photographer or inquirer desiring satisfaction for a particular type of phenomenon, every effort will be made to afford facilities for investigation to any bona fide association. The pertinent fact is that every statement made dealing with the séance work, and every photograph taken, are capable of being redemonstrated. 1. This statement is stressed to meet the only possible criticism that, in spite of the independent corroboration, the phenomena described are the product of imagination, and that a conspiracy embracing hundreds of people and impartial organizations has produced staged photographs, one written before the decease of the medium. It must be emphasized that there are other mediums through whose agency similar phenomena may be witnessed. If the reader accepts the evidence that the supernormal activities did take place, the following observations may be helpful in arriving at a fundamental decision. 1. Each phenomenon is a deliberate act, planned from its commencement to its completion. 2. To produce phenomena, law-governed forces are employed. 3. To produce phenomena consciously, or subconsciously, is beyond human effort, mental or physical. 4. To employ forces within man's knowledge, intelligent direction is required. 5. To employ spirit forces, intelligent direction is also required. 6. The execution of an act of phenomena demands the application and combination of both spirit agencies and physical forces. 7. To have gained such knowledge, the operating intelligence can only have obtained wisdom through experience and thought activity. This experience has not been gained through human effort and therefore cannot be the product of the subconscious mind. 8. It is reasonable to accept verbal evidence of survival coexistent with the phenomena as part of the phenomena. 9. It is reasonable to accept that a form of existence continues after death through the recreation in physical forms of persons who have passed over, together with the ability to recognize and be recognized, and to converse intelligently about common memories. These observations lead to this question: what can be the nature of the directing intelligence able to control and direct both the spirit and physical forces? Logic affirms that it must of necessity be a discarnate or spirit intelligence. This is further demonstrated when it is considered that this intelligence must be in touch with other spirit people in order to provide for them the means to communicate through human mediumship. Logic also affirms that there must be a further period of individual activity after the earthly phase of existence. This brings us back to the foreword of this book, in which its purpose was clearly stated: to demonstrate that survival is a truth, a proven fact. If this book does so, its purpose has been achieved and the change in our code of values must follow. Chapter 22, The Return of Jack Webber. As stated in the obituary notice, Jack Webber passed into spirit life on March 9, 1940, at 9:30 a.m. on Sunday, March 10, at the Wandsworth branch of the Marylebone Spiritualist Association. Mrs. Bertha Harris was the medium conducting the evening service. After the meeting, she mentioned that during the service she felt she was surrounded by trumpets moving about. Then came the name of Jack Webber, with the impression that he wanted to get in touch with Harry, the author. It so happened that the author was present at that service, but owing to a late arrival had to be content with a seat in the annex, as the church was packed, and he left without speaking to anyone. There was also present a lady who knew that the medium had passed on, and after the service told Mrs. Harris what had happened, which explained the presence of the trumpets and the message, which Mrs. Harris could not understand at the time of its reception. On Tuesday, March 12, at Hendon Spiritualist Fellowship, where Mr. Webber had demonstrated on his first visit to London, and where, by the invitation of the president of the church, Mrs. Catherine Wilson, the author, first witnessed the mediumship, little comprehending the events that were to follow, of which this book is the result, a medium, Miss Eveline Gannon, was demonstrating clairvoyance when she saw Mr. Webber. Not knowing that Mr. Webber had passed on, and believing him to be physically alive, she could not understand the vision she saw. Miss Gannon relates that Mr. Webber, observing her dilemma, shook his head and disappeared. It was only afterwards, when discussing this matter with Mrs. Wilson, that she heard for the first time of the passing. On the evening of the same day, at a developing circle held for direct voice at the Great Metropolitan Spiritualist Association, a trumpet was levitated through the mediumship of Mr. Harold Evans, and Jack Webber spoke. Mr. Webber had demonstrated a number of times at this society, and amongst those present were a number of persons who had known Mr. Webber well. Apart from the message characteristic of him, the sitters recognized the tonal qualities of his voice, so that the value of the communication was evidential. On Wednesday, another medium, Mr. Harold Sharp, saw Jack Webber clairvoyantly with a company of other people, one of whom he recognized as a Mrs. Lander, a great friend of Mr. Webber's, who had passed over a few months previously. To Mr. Sharp's vision, Mr. Webber held up to him a baby. 5 weeks before Mr. Webber's passing, he had attended the funeral of a baby niece. Mr. Sharp was unaware of this incident. On the next day, Thursday, after the body had been interred, preparations had been made for a service for members of the family and the developing circle, in the house, in the evening. The chairs had been arranged, and the only light was that from a coal fire. Mr. Webber Sr., an elderly gentleman, not a strong spiritualist, entered the room with the idea of having a short rest. 115. As he opened the door, he saw his son Jack standing in the room, and instinctively stepped forward, not comprehending, and shook hands with his son. As he did so, the realization of what he was doing overcame him, and made him so distraught that he was indisposed for some hours afterwards. Mr. Webber Sr. says he saw his son as if he were really there, and felt his hand as he shook hands. During the period of the following 2 weeks, to the date when this is being written, many other reports have been received from mediums who testify that Mr. Webber has made himself known through their mediumship, but the above will serve as sufficient evidence that Mr. Webber has returned. It will be noted in all the above cases that he returned to people who knew him well, whom he liked, and in 3 cases gave evidence before the medium concerned knew of the passing. His family and friends have naturally asked why, with all Jack's protective influences, attendant healers, and spirit helpers, he should have been taken away so quickly. That question cannot be answered now, but it may yet be answered with evidence, by the new work he may undertake, in his new sphere of activity to prove survival, of which the incidents narrated may be a criterion of that to come. 116, Chapter 23, The Author Henry James, Harry, Edwards, born 1893 of London parents.